Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. We're so excited to have a soon-to-be doctor, Dr. Asha Hassan, with us. She is a doctoral candidate at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, and her work is driven by her passions for reproductive health equity, abortion access and policy, and understanding police violence as a manifestation of structural racism. Her vision for health equity, unapologetically so, centers the most marginalized, uplifts bodily autonomy, and values traditional knowledge. Working towards a world where Black people are free from reproductive oppression at all stages of the life course is key to achieving health equity. Black-led spaces unafraid of taking bold approaches to research in academia is a rarity, and this is what makes CHRHE, otherwise known as the Center for Anti-Racism Research for Health Equity, so special. And in 2020, she was named a Society of Family Planning Emerging Scholar, and in 2021, she was named a National Birth Equity Research Scholar. In addition to her scholarship, she is committed to anti-racist narrative change. As a part of this, she has given expert interviews on racism, equity, and reproductive health with media outlets like The Guardian, ProPublica, Minnesota Public Radio, and Wisconsin Public Radio, KSTP Channel 5, and the Sahan Journal. She earned her Bachelor's of Arts in Gender and Women's Studies from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, her Master's in Public Health and Maternal and Child Health Epidemiology from the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, and she is currently pursuing a PhD. I know, again, as we stated earlier, her defense is coming up real soon at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. So a big, big welcome to you, Asha, on our program today. So we're excited to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, definitely our pleasure. Before we start, what led you to this call regarding abortion, reproductive health, and anti-racism?
Yeah, it's definitely a story of trying to find my path as far as what I was really interested in, as far as public health. And I knew I was, from a very early age, that I was interested in working in communities and really trying to understand the things that we kind of implement as barriers in our culture and our society that make being healthy and experiencing joy even more difficult. So I knew I was interested in doing something kind of in that realm, and just over time just found myself continuously drawn to reproductive health issues that had to do with bodily autonomy generally. I was very interested in sexual violence prevention, and I was struggling to kind of see what the common denominator was as far as like all of these things that I was, drawn to kind of figure out, well, how do we make this into a career? How does one make just not a career, but a career that is purposeful and guided by some sort of level of justice, which was really important to me. And, I'm definitely a child of my circumstances as far as experiencing in 2020 here in Minnesota. I'm based at University of Minnesota and have lived in Minnesota for a very long time, the racial justice protests. And then 2 years following that, the Dobbs decision. And it just felt at the time that I was very much so situated in the right frame to be able to ask the right questions where I was asking these questions very early on and, you know, for the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, really focused in the racial equity space, as far as where my research has been, working with the Center for Anti-Racism Research at the University of Minnesota and other organizations. And I had already had this pre-established passion about reproductive health and reproductive justice. And yet I really wasn't seeing so much of an overlap. There is really a lack of literature in the research space, as well as just kind of in our popular dialogue around how abortion restrictions and abortion bans are firmly rooted in what we know to be racially motivated and at times just simply racist histories around policy decision-making contemporaneously, as well as historically in the United States. So when we look at kind of like the history of how we got to this point, it's very much so informed by race and, you know, ideas around, you know, who deserves to have children, who doesn't deserve to have children, and how to control different populations. So if you understand this like historical element of how this is very firmly rooted in how we understand race and racism in the United States, and yet you don't really see the empirical data that really shows and explains this or grounds this as a central part of how we got here, then we're kind of having a half story around the story of abortion as well as just reproductive rights and policy broadly. So that's kind of the center of kind of realizing all of these things as kind of seeing a lack of that connective tissue right at the same time as some of these big dialogues that we're having on a national as well as a local level of what is happening with racial injustice as well as restrictions on bodily autonomy and just really wanting to put those two conversations in dialogue.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Definitely deeply rooted, as I hear, passion that you are translating, not just personally, but also in academia in your work. And we were privileged to read a few of your articles that you published individually, but also co-published with your colleagues in the field. And this is a particular topic you really don't hear too much about. You hear about tear gas and the effects of tear gas, but you never really hear the correlation between that in reproductive health. And this is for our audience, article entitled Health Issues in Healthcare Utilization Among Adults Who Reported Exposure to Tear Gas During the 2020 Portland, Oregon Protests, cross-sectional survey. So please explain the effects of tear gas on reproductive health.
Yeah, so this paper and another following paper really focus on data collection of people's experiences during the 2020 protest movement, specifically calling attention to what was being reported somewhat in the lay media at the time, as far as people reporting experiencing changes to their reproductive health that they were not expecting, specifically people who had otherwise been amenorrheic. So they were not menstruating and had not menstruated for years, whether that was because of a form of birth control that they were on or because of testosterone use or, you know, for a wide range of reasons. And they would report having this experience of, you know, going into a place where they were being exposed to tear gas, whether that was directly at a protest or in their homes or just walking in their neighborhood. They would describe these experiences and immediate changes, extreme cramping, as well as, you know, immediate menstruation and really wanting to understand if this was maybe a stress reaction or if this was a reaction to the chemicals that they were being exposed to. So I was personally hearing this in my community at the time in 2020. And, you know, as a researcher, I'm going to do the first thing is go to PubMed, do a little Google Scholar search, try and understand what is already being published on this topic. And what we saw was that there was just a dearth of knowledge. We had so little information about this intersection, in part because a lot of the research that we have on tear gas generally has been explored in the military setting. So a lot of studies from the 50s, the 60s that are exclusively on able-bodied men and people who do not have uteruses. And I think that that is really, you know, kind of a flaw as far as us utilizing this and saying, yeah, it just causes tears. When we really have not actually tested what these products actually do that we know cause physical harm, right? They cause physical harm and at times in extreme cases can be lethal. And yet we have no idea what kind of these reproductive consequences are, how this might affect people who have uteruses, people who are women identified, people who are disabled, people who are children. This was really alarming to me. So I started working on my own kind of like national scoping of this project, and also worked in collaboration with some folks out in Oregon, where there was a very large use of tear gas during the summer of 2020. I think they had over 100 days of tear gas exposure, at just large quantities. So what we did was we sent out a survey anonymously to folks who were kind of involved in protest groups in Portland at the time. And we essentially just asked them about what they were experiencing. And what we noticed is that the longer someone said that they had been exposed to tear gas, so if they'd been exposed for one day compared to 5 days, compared to 10 days, the more likely they were to report having some of these adverse effects, specifically around reproductive health, such as abnormal menstrual bleeding, breast tenderness, dysmenorrhea. So really just having things that they were not expecting and kind of seeing this as the tip of the iceberg, right? You know, this is what we're able to acknowledge in this specific moment. A cross-sectional study really tells us, you know, kind of correlation. It's not really able to give us this causation because it's a snapshot in time. But the fact that we're able to see this dose response can tell us quite a bit about what is potentially happening here and give us insights into what future investigations need to be as far as, hey, if this is affecting someone's reproductive health potentially at this very micro level, as far as just kind of, you know, pain and discomfort and abnormal bleeding, what does this mean for an example, fertility? Or what does this mean for maternal and child health outcomes? So really kind of seeing this as a first step in being able to explore the opportunity here for being able to understand what the reproductive health impacts are. And I would like to just say, you know, this is a very difficult type of question to ask. The context in which tear gas is utilized is oftentimes politically complicated. And, you know, when we look at other circumstances in which people have tried to research tear gas in places like Bahrain, in Chile, it has been in specific times of where you can't really collect research data in a way that is very, you know, clean and organized and going to give you the answers that you feel so certain about. But we do have a lot of extensive data that's more anecdotal coming out of those places that has shown, for an example, health organizations that have noticed a rise in miscarriage, for an example, in communities that have been exposed to tear gas for extensive periods of time. So this is really building off of what we already kind of knew from like an anecdotal perspective and trying to put numbers and empirical evidence behind some of these assertions so that the people that are being exposed in these circumstances, one, know what's happening to them, know that they're believed, as well as understanding that this is a part of a larger policy discussion around what is appropriate to be putting into our communities as far as chemicals.
Yeah, absolutely. And before, I know my colleague, Dr. Barwise, had a response, a question in regards to the logistics of the survey. I can't help but to correlate the historical dynamics of gas using on Mexican immigrants, for example, the 1917 Bath Riot, and how gas was used to deter Mexican individuals to cross the border. And actually, this was the same tactic used under former President Donald Trump's administration, and how the health consequences of that, obviously we can't measure because a lot of these individuals are no longer here, but it's just interesting to see how these particular mechanisms used by law enforcement, by the state, it continues against individuals of color. So I just wanted to make that a quick comment before Amelia jumps on and asks you a follow-up question about your study.
Yeah, no, thanks. I think it was really interesting the way you did the study, and you've got a couple of papers out about it. Another thing, apart from the reproductive implications, you also discuss some of the more general symptoms like GI symptoms, psychological symptoms, and then healthcare utilization. So can you talk a little bit about the impact of the tear gas on healthcare utilization generally?
Yeah, so some of these pieces, I think the novel finding is definitely the reproductive health piece. And some of these pieces around the gastrointestinal issues, as well as honestly some things that we didn't necessarily find in our survey, but are well documented, such as, you know, blindness is even on the CDC's website. These are things that have been established as far as what are the potential consequences of tear gas, especially at larger quantities. But one of the things that we were interested in is how this is affecting the healthcare system, specifically with that study. And we did find that a lot of people did utilize the healthcare system, but a lot of people simply just didn't. They might not necessarily have access to healthcare, people who weren't really sure what they were experiencing and if this warranted going in to see a doctor, really a wide range of emotions. And I will say, as a non-published piece of some of this research was some interviews that I conducted with people who had been exposed. And this is what they, you know, this is what they were echoing was, you know, that they, one, weren't really sure if this was something that arose to going in to see a provider. And this is, you know, when we start thinking about the intersections, I think a lot of women and people who have uteruses don't necessarily always go and, you know, talk to their provider about abnormal changes to their menstruation or to their reproductive health broadly until it's, you know, something that is, you know, completely out of the realm of what they've reasoned with themselves. And I think we saw a little bit of that. We also heard, you know, in some of the interviews of people talking about going to see their provider and being told, you know, you're probably just stressed. Like, this is a stressful time. You're probably just stressed. This is just, you know, normal, and check back in with me in a few weeks. And how discouraged they felt and feeling a sense of dismissal in some ways, which is also very grounded in what we know about how women and people who menstruate experience the healthcare system sometimes. So we were kind of getting a lot of different answers as far as how people are utilizing the healthcare system. And we did want to kind of, in this specific paper, put a wide net in what we were referring to as healthcare utilization. And this included also people who were utilizing medics that were, you know, working at the protest sites, people who are going to their primary care provider, but also people going to seek emergency medicine services. So a whole range of different things that we kind of put on, under this umbrella of healthcare utilization. But I can, from the conversations I've had with people and the qualitative interviews, I can make the strong, I feel comfortable saying that people are not using the healthcare system as much as, this is an underreporting. I think there is for sure more people who would have experienced some of these changes and did not actually end up using the healthcare system to be able to even document some of the things that they were experiencing.
Yeah, and I just want to add, as you point out in your articles, these things are banned during warfare, and yet they're used on communities, which is very disturbing. I'm going to hand it back to Kirk.
Oh, thank you. So another really great article, More Than Tears, Associations Between Exposure to Chemical Agents Used by Law Enforcement in Adverse Reproductive Outcomes. It's pretty much a follow-up question with the previous article. Can you please describe the correlation between the chemicals law enforcement use and reproductive health outcomes. In the lens of, and you did allude to this earlier, but in the lens of if there is information and more research about the reproductive or the, you know, negative consequential reproductive outcomes, do you think that this particular tactic will be alleviated or at least used a lot less, or you think it really doesn't matter, this particular tactic will still be used within law enforcement circles?
So those are two great questions. So this study, this second study on the Moore and Tears paper, is essentially following the same question as the previous paper. However, it is on a national scale. So we, instead of just having this one city that we were looking at, we were looking at folks across the country. And we had a pretty significant portion of those folks disproportionately in the Midwest and the Pacific Northwest, which makes sense given what was happening at the time. But still very much so a national study that was open to anyone, as well as open to anyone across time. So we had people who were reporting in this specific study who were from earlier time periods. We've not published that data quite yet. This data specifically focuses on kind of this 2020 time period and 2021 to some extent. But we really were able to kind of confirm the same things that were happening in Portland kind of at this national scale, which really shows us that this isn't necessarily just a, you know, what is happening in one city, that we're seeing some of these kind of dose responses as far as how often people are being exposed to tear gas and that it being related to some of these adverse health outcomes around reproductive health. As far as the question around policy, I'll say on a local level here in Minneapolis, I know our police department has, you know, responded in some ways as far as what their internal policies are. However, I don't think there's been quite yet much traction as far as thinking through what the policy changes could look like, or if there should be policy changes around what chemical agents should be used or should not be used during a protest setting. And I think that's a very important conversation to have, especially, you know, as we see there's lots of data that shows that protests that have predominantly people of color are more likely to experience these forms of chemical violence directed at them by police. And thinking about really what the health equity implications are of having populations that are already marginalized, that are already suffering in some circumstances, being disproportionately exposed to tear gas, not just in a protest setting, but also seeping into homes, having children potentially being exposed to these, and vulnerable persons and people with disabilities. So I think there's, you know, a lot to be said about what that conversation should be. And I know there is some, you know, federal folks that are looking at this, and there have been conversations kind of on state levels and city levels post 2020. But I don't think we've quite reached a point where people have taken it seriously enough to take these health consequences seriously. I will say, you know, one of the things that we did find in this article that was concerning to us, but not a large enough number to really dive into further, was having people who were reporting miscarriages. I think we had a handful or so folks who reported experiencing a miscarriage after their exposure to tear gas. And that is a worthy inquiry for future research, is thinking about what are not just the acute reproductive health changes, but what are the potentials here around long-term and, you know, some serious outcomes around maternal and child health. So that is kind of the next step here as far as thinking about what research, and hopefully research that can inform policy to be better.
Thank you. Another area that you've focused on is disability justice, particularly as it pertains to abortion access. So can you share what you found here and what your thoughts are on this area. And you've also considered chronic health conditions. You've kind of included that in your disability justice sort of framework. So can you speak more about that?
Yeah, and I'll just start out by saying that I see these three areas that we're discussing, the police violence, tear gas piece, the abortion access piece, and the disability justice piece as very interrelated. These are all focused on the idea of bodily autonomy, the right that someone has to their own body, and the ways in which the state, the way in which our communities or our society is formed, limits people's autonomy. So that's kind of the through line between these three topics. But the work on disability justice really focuses on the fact that this is a very underexplored, underacknowledged intersection for a lot of people, especially because we know that people who are racialized are disproportionately disabled. And really thinking about how this works when we think about gender and sex in the healthcare system. So people who are chronically ill, disproportionately women, and seeing how this works within the healthcare system as far as how people receive care, as well as how we prioritize what care looks like for people. So one of the things that we really were interested in was to paint a picture in what was happening with people who experienced chronic illness and the Dobbs decision. So we, for an example, were seeing reports early in that time period about people who were using methotrexate or some chronic illnesses, including lupus, that were really struggling to get access to these medications because, some providers were scared, some pharmacists were scared, and were concerned of, is this violating the Dobbs decision? Methotrexate is also potentially an abortifacient. So really thinking about how we think about medications and prioritizing what the health of people who are of reproductive age is, and how complex that gets when we're in an environment where abortion is not an option for people. So especially thinking about the ways in which pregnancy can be extremely complicated for all people, but especially people who are already chronically ill or people who are experiencing disabilities where, throughout the course of the pregnancy, there may be potentially complications that arise that are not necessarily, conducive to continuing a pregnancy in the way that that person wants. So really wanting to put those things in conversation and acknowledging how the Dobbs decision really puts these communities who are already maybe experiencing complex experiences with the reproductive healthcare system and access to medications, access to care that is not ableist, and now having this extra burden of trying to navigate that with abortion restrictions. So wanting to really put those things in dialogue, also thinking about reproductive justice, which is 30 years old this year. Reproductive justice is the right to have a child, the right not to have a child, and the right to parent in safe and sustainable communities, and how correlated and in conversation that is with disability justice, which is a social movement focusing on examining disability and ableism, and how that also intersects with other forms of oppression, such as racism and classism and sexism. So putting those two forms of justice in dialogue with each other for the sake of really understanding that it allows us to frame justice for people who are kind of sitting at these intersections and experiencing not just the general harms of the Dobbs decision, but are experiencing it the specific construct of it potentially disrupting what their usual care might be or their standard of care, as well as what their options might be as far as what treatment is.
Oh, thank you. So I know that you expounded on disability justice, and of course, how that correlates with reproductive justice. In today's society, how does a patient with pre-existing conditions navigate an abortion procedure? This question was spurred out of another interesting article entitled Dobbs and Disability, Implications of Abortion Restrictions for People with Chronic Health Conditions.
Yes, thank you for that question. So I think they navigate it similarly to any other community as far as the technical aspects of it, right? So we know that medication abortion, for an example, is safer than Tylenol. It is very accessible in places such as Minnesota, where I live, as far as people being able to access that at home, so they can be mailed to them for people who have maybe physical disabilities or are not able to necessarily come into a clinic. And, you know, in an ideal universe where there aren't necessarily these same policy restrictions in other states, this could theoretically be, you know, pretty accessible and a way to reduce the effects of ableism in someone accessing care, as we've seen telehealth be utilized in other circumstances. However, what the issues and where we see kind of this structural ableism play out as far as accessing and navigating abortion care is really around the getting the access, and two, not getting the access when someone doesn't want to. So we do see, you know, this role of eugenics, which is, you know, this long held, you know, belief of that some people deserve to have children and some people don't deserve to have children. And really seeing people with disabilities, sometimes really, and people with chronic illnesses also, really struggling to have the support they want, to have the families that they desire. And sometimes the route to have the families that people desire is complex, right? Sometimes that is requires, you know, potentially in vitro fertilization, or it requires, you know, abortions. Sometimes the complexity of especially somebody who might be on medications that are teratogenic or abortifacients might need more support in being able to access and have the families that they want. And sometimes part of that navigation does include accessing abortion care. So really thinking about how to take a 30,000 foot view on the situation and understanding that people's individual reproductive lives are sometimes very complex, and how to support them through navigating and accessing what they need at that given time and trusting their agency in achieving that. So that's our job as kind of, you know, those of us who are either providers or in advocacy space or want what's best for patients. But, you know, generally, as far as the actual procedure, or the, you know, you're actually having the abortion, we know this is just a very safe experience for people. And what makes things dangerous is, one, legal restrictions that makes things criminally dangerous for people, as well as, you know, the complexity of having to navigate accessing care in settings that are barriers that don't need to exist. For example, having someone go into a clinic when they would have preferred just to have had access to their pills at home and not necessarily had to deal with the barriers of access in that way, in which some states have now banned telehealth for abortion care. So these are the ways in which we really see this kind of coming to light as far as for people who have pre-existing conditions, as well as people with other forms of disabilities as well.
Yeah, interesting. A follow-up question. I'm curious about your thoughts on how does the Dobb decision impact the autonomy of women? And I know we're in a political climate. To our listeners, of course, this is 2024. Presidential election coming, of course, this fall between two main party candidates. Obviously, we have laws that have unfortunately backtracked, you know, to some point of view, progress in this country. Obviously, we talked about the Dobbs decision, overturning of Roe versus Wade. More recently, at the time of this recording, overturning of affirmative action. But also other inquiries are really in the political circle, really are talking about other particular triumphs, particularly out of the 1960s civil rights movement. And it wasn't just, of course, you know, freedom and autonomy for people of color, but of course, you know, many other movements arise out of that in that particular time frame. Women's rights movement, queer community as well, disabilities rights out of that particular era. And of course, what you talked about in our recording, there's a lot of intersectionality between all of those particular dynamics and demographics that you're studying about. I'm saying this long question, right, this long diatribe, just to pick your brain a little bit about your concern about autonomy and patient autonomy, one of the foundational principles, right, that we all know and learn in bioethics. How can we navigate these murky waters? And I know this is a heavy, heavy loaded question, but I'm just curious on some suggestions in the political climate we live in currently.
Yeah, this is a great question. And I think it's incredibly important, as, you know, now that Roe v. Wade has been overturned and there's this fragmentation of how we think about abortion policy on this to like more of the state and local level. We have, you know, 50 different political environments around abortion care and access in the United States. And really, for folks that are in positions where they are able to push their state legislatures, their like local government to support access, thinking about what it means to not just replicate Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade is very much so, as we say in the movement, the floor, not the ceiling, and really does not center this conversation around autonomy. It doesn't center this, you know, the, you know, literature that talks about how people who have more autonomy in their health decisions and in their lives experience better health outcomes. So really thinking about what does this framing look like? Is this, you know, kind of what is already existing in kind of the federal conversation around it's just a right to privacy? Or is it actually about what we believe in what people's lives deserve to look like and what they should be able to achieve for themselves if they so choose to, which is really kind of that centering of bodily autonomy. So really kind of that shifting around what policy looks like and the framing around that is, I think, vital. Also, thinking about, as I was saying, Roe v. Wade was very limiting in some ways. In one way specifically is not really supporting people who are having abortions later on in their gestation, which, as we know from the literature, people who are having abortions later on in their gestation do tend to be experiencing very unique sets of circumstances, such as, you know, complex pregnancies, as well as very precarious relationship situations, not being able to access care because of a varying number of reasons. So really thinking about what does it mean to have a big tent approach to what access and autonomy looks like in that conversation as well. And thinking about, you know, what does it look like to include people who are the most marginalized in those circumstances? So for an example, I always think about, you know, children who are disproportionately likely to be later on in their gestation when they are seeking abortion care, and how they're left out of kind of the policy frames that we have around gestational limits that don't really acknowledge the complexity of people's individual lives. So that's kind of one consideration. I also think there is an opportunity here to look to our neighbors, in Latin America, who have really, you know, done the exact opposite of us, you know, they're in what's called the Green Wave movement, as far as being able to implement serious policy change around decriminalization of abortion and increasing access to abortion care in a way that was very different from how reproductive health organizations and politics works in the US, which was from the grassroots up. They really focused on building community and consolidating consensus around what people believed in, and kind of doing this, you know, more so direct advocacy approach, and was really successful and has been really successful in building real serious policy change in Latin America over the last several years. So what can we learn from our neighbors? I think is a big key here. And thinking through, one, how to, in the context where we do have an opportunity to implement constructive policy, centering that in a way that centers bodily autonomy, not just the concept of what we think is an appropriate abortion or an inappropriate abortion, which is more rooted in things that we don't always know. So,
you know, thank you for that. I mean, I think your work is absolutely fascinating and, you know, very good luck with your upcoming defense. Are you able to share with us what you're working on now and what the next phase will be when you get your PhD?
Yeah, so my dissertation work is focused on a lot of these issues. It's looking at the relationship between racism and abortion access specifically. It will be, when it's published, it will be the first empirical study kind of looking at that association between structural racism from a quantitative perspective and the measures that we know allow us to understand and understand how structural racism operates and measures of abortion access specifically in the state of Minnesota. I am really excited about that and being able to show some of the results of that hopefully in the coming months. And, you know, I'm continuing my work on disability, very much so interested in thinking not just about kind of just publishing and producing papers in that realm, but also what does it look like to have a focus on community education, provider education, and thinking about how we are more inclusive in the healthcare system around people with disabilities and people with chronic illnesses. And then in the tear gas space, I'm currently working on a project focused on being able to ask the same question, but specifically in the context of preterm birth and some of the infant related outcomes that can hopefully give us a lot more information about the role of tear gas in reproductive health, specifically from the maternal and child outcome perspective. So that's what I'm working on. I'm planning on, you know, staying here in Minnesota after I graduate and hopefully being able to continue this type of work. And that is the plan for now.
That's fabulous. Well, thank you so much for coming today to Bioethics in the Margins. It's been great talking to you and we wish you all the best.
Yeah, it's all the best to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.